Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
ここいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ。どこにいるのかな。見えない。
こんなところ。
I miss you.
Welcome, friends, to a very special episode of Waypoint Radio. I am so excited. I am not in a bunker. I am in a control room, and I am here with a couple of my best friends.
Aww.
I'm also here with a very special guest. I'm going to let my special guest go first. I am here, and so is Adam Conover.
Hello. That was a very weighty intro.
Yeah, heavy stuff.
I wanted to dig in. I want you to ruin Waypoint Radio today, Adam. I want you to ruin it for us,
no,
please.
I want to come and help out.
Oh,
but that's true on your show anyway.
You
ruin things. You're trying to help out.
Yeah, you're actually helping.
The ruin is a little bit of a superficial promise on Adam Ruins Everything. And instead, you know, at the end, we tell you why all the horrible facts you learned actually give you more power and efficacy and happiness in the world. But let's see. I don't know. What could I do about Waypoint? I mean, in the past, I would have talked about Vice's labor policies, but we were just talking about how you guys are organized now.
That's
and
true.
We just had a contract negotiation and it sounded like it went well. So I can't talk about that. I don't know. You guys should have a real podcast studio.
That would be sick.
That would be really tight.
I'm not upset about not having it, but this is totally
fine.
We're
providing entertainment. You have water. You have never been kissed
on TV. You guys only record 8 or 9 podcasts a week.
That's all.
That's it.
Something like that.
Something like that. Well, you know, we'll pass those words up to the higher ups, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it would be like, excuse me, we had a very important TV man. He was here today in our control room, and he said we need a real podcast studio.
Yeah, you're the only one with the clout to get us there,
honestly.
All you need is a small room with a table and 3 microphones.
That's it.
It's true. I tried to talk to my students today in a crawl space. So that was going well. I should probably introduce also. I was so excited to have you here, Adam. But I'm also excited to be here, of course, with Austin.
Hey.
And Natalie.
Hi.
And this is our Friday show. So we're going to have fun.
Yeah.
We dig deep on Fridays. We do deep dives.
People are listening to this one all through the weekend.
That's
when
true.
I listen to the show, which I do since the
Thank
last time
you.
I was
Thank
on.
You.
Since the last time I was on, I've started listening extremely regularly, and I need the Friday show to get me through all my weekend chores.
Right.
And so it's very important that episode be meaty, but also very long.
Right. Yes.
Well, take that note. Take a note. Kato, take a note. Yep. Longer on Fridays.
That's right.
Adam ruins Waypoint Radio.
I got 3 days of dishes to get through, and I know I'm not getting a new podcast till Monday. So
perfect. Yeah.
This is a real genuine question.
Yeah.
I have a hard time listening to podcasts while I do dishes because I get into like a zen state when I do dishes, and I'm not listening anymore. I'm just sort of like dealing with math problems and also the problems of the universe and all these big questions in my head. And I'm just sort of like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if I did this with my life? And then 10 minutes of the podcast. It's just, it happened and I don't know what it was.
Well, partially what I'd say is that's why this format of podcast is good for that, because a chat show where people are chatting, one of the advantages is you can tune out and then tune back in.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that it's, you know,
you're telling people to stop listening to our show. I get it.
You just get it. You get the thread, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas with an audiobook, for instance, like narrative fiction in an audiobook is the kind of thing where once you're gone for a second, then you've lost it forever and you're never going to find out where are they now. So that's part of why I think it works. But also, I don't. Do you find that because you're an athlete?
Yes.
Right?
And it is true.
True listener. True listener status.
Yeah, he really does listen. Proof. He really does.
I really do listen. I know a lot. I heard about Natalie and Hollow Knight. I know. I got to play Battletech. I haven't played Battletech because I just got my PC rig all set up again.
Hell yeah. Nice.
I know about how much Danielle's been playing Into the Breach last year. I'm up to speed on, almost everything.
Check.
Every box.
But always felt something distinguished me from athletes. I thought is because I like to exercise, but I know that, for instance, like distance runners clear their minds, right? And they're just like a column of air and motion, right?
Wow.
Like that's something that I read once, like elite distance runners, right? And do you have that experience when you do tasks? Do you like, does your brain?
She is a distance runner. Is the sport she was. That is the thing I know about.
I was the captain of my cross country team in college. Yes.
So did you have that experience?
Sometimes if you really get in the zone, it is like that.
Yeah.
But on most of your training runs, you know, you're not racing other people. It is definitely like, oh my God, does this person like me? Or what's actually going on? And oh my, I can't believe I spat up on my cool racing bib. That's terrible.
So my brain almost never does that.
Okay.
And so I am always looking to have my mind be actively engaged. And that's like how I relax. So like I can't really ever do one thing at a time. And like, I like the idea of meditating. And
Sounds nice.
This is true. I spend, instead of meditating, I listen to like Dharma talks by like people who to teach you how to meditate, but they're just like talking about the principles. But I never can actually meditate. Like the actual practice of doing just one thing, I can almost never have patience for. So that's one of the things that podcasts are important for me, is I never get to a Zen state. I need the companionship.
Mm. How do you sleep? Because
true question.
Like a baby.
Big same. Okay, well, good. No, I'm going the other way with it, which is that, like, for me, I want that. I can't sleep until it feels like I have been tuckered all the way out. I need my brain to have been complete, have hit empty for me to actually fall asleep. Because like you, I just always going. It's just I need input all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. It's a tough one.
I used to have more trouble sleeping when I was younger and when I took more prescription stimulants. Now I am usually so exhausted that I go to sleep it does happen for me.
So Prestors is the way to do it.
Prestors shooting
four different things.
Shooting a TV show for 14 to 16 hours a day will make you go to sleep like
sounds
a baby.
Great. Yeah. Sounds great. They'll move us into a TV studio next. I'll put us in a corner. That'll be great.
You just curl up there, you know?
Speaking of TV stuff, like what are you working on right now? Like, I think we all know about Adam Ruins Everything, but like, is there anything else that you should be putting on our plate?
I am, let's see. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll talk about this. It was just announced. I'm doing a short season podcast with Starburns Audio and IGN that's called Humans Who Make Games. And I interviewed a bunch of game developers, which was really just my friend who works at Starburns was like, you want to do a podcast? And I was like, I also had this idea that I'd just like to sit down with game developers for a while and talk with them. And I'm not a games media person, so don't be mad at me. Now
you
I'm
are
nervous.
Now.
Now I'm
now
nervous.
You're mad. Are you locked the door.
Are you guys mad that I'm horning in on your world?
Anytime anyone is doing anything to shine a light on what the work is that goes into making games, I'm here
for it.
So
that was the goal. The feed is up. The first episode is not up, but people can go subscribe to it now. I think the first episode comes out the week after this podcast airs. I wanted to have like a long form personal conversation with game developers because I never felt like we get that, right? We get a lot of, there's so much media that's like, you know, YouTube people analyzing, you know, like some British guy talking about why Nier is great for 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
But then like, where's my 2-hour interview with the developer of Nier and how they, you know, got into, and of course, well, I'd need to speak Japanese, but, bad example.
Yes.
But so on this podcast, I talked with, first episode, I'm talking with Edmund McMillan. I talked with Derek Yu, who created Spelunky.
Nice.
Christine Love is on it.
Awesome.
Justin Ma from Into the Breach.
Yeah.
Yes.
I talked with the folks from Game Devs Unite. That's the name of the organization,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Game Workers Unite.
Game Workers Unite.
Sorry.
That's not quite right.
Game Workers Unite.
Awesome. Emma Kidwell or someone else?
Emma,
Emma's great.
Nice.
And and it's like it starts from a, you know, starting point of like, what was your childhood like and that sort of thing? And what is your day to day? And just trying to get that like really personal impression of what it was like to create these things. Because, you know, I mean, I'm a creator. I create comedy, but I'm always like, what is it like to have a game idea?
Yeah.
I've played games forever, but I've never had that.
Not
thing
even an inkling, you're never like +3 swords.
Weirdly enough, no. Like I enjoy, like I feel like I have a pretty deep knowledge of game design even. Like I could talk to you guys for 3 hours about that kind of thing, but, and I listen to podcasts about that kind of thing, but I have never been like, here's what I would do, you know? Mm. And then Ben, like, okay, let me take the first. And I did that with comedy, right? I was like watching stand up or watching sketch, watching Mr. Show, and then being like, ooh, I want to write something. Let me do it at my college, you know?
Right.
So, and then what is that like day to day? So I think that we did 6 to 8 episodes. I actually forget how many. Those are going to be coming out soon. And so I'm excited about that. And then we'll hopefully do a second season if people like it. And then I'm about to go on a tour called Mind Parasites Live, which is sort of a combination of stand-up and the informational comedy I do on Adam Ruins Everything. And it's sort of like a weird live psychedelic biology class about these like biological parasites that like take over animals' minds, and then also the cultural parasites they're trying to take over our minds. I'm sorry for doing the plugs at the top of the show.
No, that's I like it. Let's use those as seeds for conversation.
Yes. And then of course Adam Ruins Everything all the time. In a week, on Monday we start shooting the last round of episodes of the current run, which we've been working on since February of 2018, so it's very, very long.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that the season would go year-round in such a way.
Pretty much. I mean, our show is so time-consuming to make because we're writing. Our last order was 16 episodes, and we have to – our show is not just a, you know, three-act, like, sitcom that has a story structure. It is that, but it's also a fully researched, you know, like, argumentative essay – and a sketch comedy show all at the same time. Every scene is shot on a different location, so it takes 4.5 days to shoot each episode. It's just like, right. I didn't realize when I created the show. When I created the show, I was working at College Humor, and I was just a online sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And what I was used to doing was pouring all of my time and energy to make every single thing I worked on as good and as big as possible. So everything I worked on had to be good in 10 different ways.
Yeah.
And so when I created the show, I was like, okay, this can't just be funny. It can't just be informative. It also needs a storyline. It also needs to be really visually fast. Da 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 da. And so that was the pilot. And I didn't realize I was creating what I believe to be the most difficult to produce show on television.
in your experience, of
yes,
course.
in my experience. Right. But it's like, I mean, people on our set are like, holy shit, what are you guys doing here? This is wild. Like we shoot like 10 pages a day, which is a lot. Oof. It's a big show. We've been to do 16 episodes, soup to nuts. I think we'll be done in April or May. So that'll have been like over a year to do 16 eps.
And in the middle of that is when you're touring with Mind Parasites?
Yes, and writing the show at the same time, which is a real mistake.
I get how you sleep now. That all makes sense. You are just exhausted.
Man, it's really, it's such a pivot to, you guys talk about work-life balance on the show, so I feel like I can, but like when you work so long in comedy, making no money, working for 10 years and just saying like the way that you do it is say, okay, well, I work my day job, I do freelance, and I go out and I do open mics every night. And so then when someone says, do you want to do a show? You have to say yes, right? Because you have to take every opportunity that comes your way. So then when I'm working on the TV show and then I'm like, all right, I want to go on tour. And I talk to my touring agent and he's like, hey, this is the best time to tour. And I'm like, well, then I'd have to write the show at the same time that I'm writing the other show. He's like, yeah, but that's the best time to tour. So do you want to tour or not? It's like, all right, I guess I will. Yep. And so it's hard to say no when people are, you know, putting those opportunities in front of you. And the only thing you have to mortgage is your own sanity, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you keep it together when you've got that much stuff going on? I mean, like, I have my own weird opinions on keeping things together while doing various things.
30 jobs.
Yeah.
Well, you do so many. You've got, like, hobbies. Or, like, you've got extracurriculars.
Hobby jobs. You know, that's what we do. But seriously, like, these things that you do are very intensive things.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, it's not just a show. It's 7 different types of show in one. And then also this other stuff. How do you keep it together? How do you kind of keep yourself from, you know, completely losing your mind and deciding I'm just going to run around naked on set and throw things at people? I don't know.
Not always well. I mean, like, so I've recently started thinking of work differently because people used to say, I used to feel like hard work was like something that people like did that was like a virtue. Like, oh my gosh, look at how much that person is able to work. And I wish I could work that much. And now I conceive of it as something that happens to you. Like you get put in a, or you put yourself in a situation where you have that much to do and then you just withstand it. Right. And so I've been trying to learn how to like take it off of myself. And so it's more that I have to say, okay, it's okay if I, you know, I had work to do the other day and I was like, no, I get to play Return of the Obra Dinn for 1 hour.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I must do that for my own sanity. And then I did that. And so
I have to wander around this deserted boat filled with dead bodies. Yeah. I must deduce.
Self-care.
And by the way, I also stream when I, twitch.tv/AdamConover.
Oh, there it is.
The true plug. I stream when I play because it actually brings me more pleasure because otherwise I'd be like with my girlfriend like, hey, look what happened in the game. It's cool. And she's like, I don't care. So it's that thing of wanting to experience with other people. Yeah. Like it fulfills that for me. But also that makes it a little bit work to be streaming.
Yep, totally.
Because
yeah.
Then I have to
be on.
I have to be on and my hair,
Your hair has to be right. Yeah.
You can't be half asleep or drooling, which, you know, are things I may have done on a stream. Yeah.
And then I find myself bargaining with like, well, I really want to play this game tonight, but I don't feel like streaming, so I guess I won't play it until tomorrow, which is so dumb.
Adam, let yourself play the game.
Just play video games.
Yeah, I know. But video games do help because video games, I can't think about work while I'm playing them because they are completely multimodal. Like they occupy every orifice.
Excuse me. You know, there are some games like that. You know,
those exist.
No kink shaming on this show.
That's true. That's one of our rules.
That is our number one rule.
Let's put on the door of the next podcast studio they give us. No kink shaming orifices.
I've got. You don't want to use some of my Joy-Cons are just for me.
Okay.
Fair.
But yeah, it's like you can't. I can't like really ruminate about my script problem that well. And actually streaming, even because some games do give you room to do that. Like if I was playing a lot of Tetris Effect, which I loved, but it did give me room to do that. And so then if I was streaming while I was playing Tetris Effect and I was also talking to people, it sort of took up that extra brain space that would otherwise be spent on that. So games do help me a bit, I guess.
So you said Obra Dinn, Tetris Effect.
Yes.
What else are you playing right now? What are you what's on your hit list?
Let's see. I'm trying to think. I just tried to play Owlboy and bounced off.
Yeah. I had similar feelings with that. Beautiful game.
Beautiful. I was like, I get how I'm supposed to like this, but if it had I was obsessed with Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight was the most I'm looking at Allie. Hollow Knight was the most consuming. It was just the perfect game. It's the experience I'm chasing of just like being so rewarding in every way.
Totally.
And having so much play in it. And I couldn't stream it because I was playing it on Switch, which was probably good for me. And so that was one of my big ones. And it was like, you know, Celeste took me a while to get through because for some reason the Massacre platforming felt like work and I would get frustrated. My hands would hurt and stuff.
Yeah.
And I never felt that way with Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight, I was just like, I have mastered this and I am ready I am ready to do the platforming challenge.
I am a knight.
Yeah. I am the Hollow Knight. I didn't do the Path of Pain.
I didn't do it either.
But the White Palace or whatever, that I was... You know, it was the exact right amount of difficult.
Totally.
Like it felt perfect to me in that moment. And so I was just like locked in on that perfectly. That was earlier this year.
Did you see? So we were just, Natalie and I were just watching the Hollow Knight speed run from AGDQ.
I didn't catch it.
There is, that dude goes through the Path of Pain with such clarity of purpose.
Grace.
Just beauty in every movement. Doesn't touch a single...
It is upsetting.
Wow.
Getting through the Path of Pain was probably one of the most rewarding not the Path of Pain.
The White Palace.
Was probably one of the most rewarding video game experiences I had last year because I was like, I'm not a platformer person. Mm-hmm. I can't do these things. I don't have finesse.
Yeah.
And then getting through that was awesome. And then watching the speedrunner do that and then like do that beat the final boss, like the true ending.
Oh, I saw the clip of that.
Yeah, and then immediately go into the Path of Pain and just fly through it. I was like, I'm fucking terrible at video games. I need to stop.
That's the bonus.
Yeah, you know? No, it was.
But that final boss, the Radiance, are you guys past spoiler territory on Hollow Knight?
We can say right now, we're going to talk spoilers for Hollow Knight.
Spoilers. Okay, 5 minutes.
So the final boss was one of those beautiful game experiences of you're playing it and you're like, I can't do this. Yeah. Why does the game think I can do it? I can't do it. But then you like, I'll try it again. And then you're like, oh, I did do it.
I did at least a little bit of it.
Yeah. And you get better without realizing that you are. And then so when you actually do it, mm-hmm. you feel like you feel like an athlete, and it feels like it has made you an athlete. You're like, I am stronger now.
Yeah, totally.
Right? I have done it. I have gotten better. I have achieved a skill.
Yeah.
As you can feel the progress in yourself, which is like so incredibly rewarding.
Are you gonna do the Godmaster? Have you watched any of it?
No, I have the DLC. I did the DLC that came with the Switch version, and then the ones that I saw come out were like some boss rush type modes or something.
Yeah, that's the Godmaster mode. It's like all like most of the bosses revisited harder.
I want content. I just want content. Yeah. And I'm not
there
interested.
There is a little bit of content in it. Austin and I spoiled it for ourselves the other day. We were like, we're not going to play this.
What I would really like is like a new area with like a new vibe.
Yeah.
Because that's what that game does so well.
Yeah. Uncovering the areas and finding, you know, going into the deep nest or whatever and all those things.
Oh, God.
It's like this. I had the same experience with like Breath of the Wild where like I savored opening the last part of the map, you know, and revealing the, you know, like climbing the towers and everything. I was like, that I know once it's all open, I can't do that again.
Totally.
And that's the same way I felt about Hollow Knight. And then so when the Zelda DLC came out, I was like, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
Like, I went back to it. I've been going back to like Zelda and Mario Odyssey to say, like, hey, I didn't do a lot of those things. Let me just go back and do some. Mario Odyssey is still a delight. And Zelda, I did one of the, from the second DLC, one of the legs of the quest where it opens three map points, you go to the things in the map points, and I did it, and I did the new shrines, and I was like,
it's pretty good. Oh, here's what I'll say.
The cutscene is nice, but I just want a new map.
I know, me too.
Yes,
the best gift someone could give me would be like, oh, you didn't know? If you do blah, 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 you get one more little region on that map. That would be the best gift a human could give me. But it is not the same feeling, but the Trial of the Sword first DLC, which is what I thought I would not want at all, because combat challenge DLC is like the number one thing just completely turns me off.
Yeah.
Arkham Games did them. Everybody does this where it's like, oh, just fight these six enemies. Yeah. I don't care. Though that Trial of the Sword stuff was actually really fascinating because they're really not just challenging in the combat sense, but in the design sense, where what you're given is a very limited amount of resources to use.
Yes.
It's almost like an extension of Eventide Isle.
Yeah, totally.
More than of just like, it's a combat.
And I thought that was great. I didn't go that far in it, but I loved the design. I loved like, oh shit, yeah, I start with a stick.
Right.
I gotta kill I don't have enough stuff to kill these choo-choos or whatever.
Yeah, you got it.
And it also seemed to be that sort of thing that people who, I didn't play Far Cry 2, but the people who are like, I love Far Cry 2, I feel like would like that.
Totally. Lots of grenades rolling down hills.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. So I definitely appreciated that bit. But yeah, I mean, I left on the map. And what I did last time I booted up Breath of the Wild was I literally, the big mountain in the top left corner of the map, Hebra Mountain.
Yes.
I actually never explored in the main part of the game. And I haven't done every shrine either, but I got the true ending, you know?
Right.
And I felt I explored everything, but I left that. And for like a year, I was like, one day I'll go to that mountain. And I liked the fact that I didn't know what was up there.
Yeah.
And then on a long Christmas trip, I plugged it and I started playing more. I don't think there was anything that amazing up there.
No, there's like a snowboarding section and like some cool skeletons.
Yeah,
but
I wanted
that's
that.
Not the best area. You know Laurelin Village, the little fishing village in the southeast?
Yes.
In the jungle area? So I was at hour 100 before I found that whole region.
What?
Yeah. And that was the best feeling.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? How
that
is
place
there...
is so dense. It's... and
yes.
I found that last two. I was like, when I found that, I was like, there's another town?
Yeah, exactly.
There's another town. Or the thing where there's a different mountain in like more the center of the map that has the dragon at the top.
Yes.
Mm. And discovering that is like, that is the perfect.
Yeah.
You're just like roaming around. You're like, what is that? What is it? Oh my God. I got a, it's a dragon and it's a sick dragon.
And like, I gotta heal this dragon.
Screenshot.
Just for whatever reason, I've been trying to figure out for so long. Cause I played Skyrim years back and I loved Skyrim and the feeling of being like, oh my God, the world's so huge and stuff. But then I played lots of open world games where I was just like, all right, this just feels rote. But then for some reason, that game, Breath of the Wild, I just remember the feeling of when I went down from the plateau. I'm sorry, this is
We're in it.
We're in it.
The right room for this conversation.
Do it. Okay, so I just like went down from the plateau and I was like on my way to Kakariko Village and I like almost became nauseous from the scope of what was before me. Yeah. I was like, the map is this big. And there's this much stuff. And I was like, okay, I could go to Kakariko Village, but if I just went that way, there would just be world in that direction with people and villages and unique things. And like, I would be going there. There's a tree on the top of a lone tree. And there's something up there.
Right.
And I was just like, I felt staggered from, like, I had trouble taking steps because I was so overwhelmed by the amount of. And I don't know what it is about it that made it feel that way. Where Fallout 4 didn't feel or
it.
Whatever.
Like, I got this gun. I'm gonna go kill these super mutants. Yeah.
I think it's because it's not copy and paste the way a lot of open world games feel. Like you're doing the same 7 activities or whatever. Say it's the most expansive open world type of game. You're doing the same 9 activities in different variations and maybe slightly different art styles. But this actually felt like a sort of. It has immersive sim elements. It has platforming elements. It has all these different elements, and everything felt like a separate biome.
Yeah.
Like an actually different little world that actually operates in slightly different ways, different environmental effects, different things you need to do that actually made it feel like this feels like diverse in a way. Even if the core activities are relatively similar.
Yeah, it's very handcrafted.
Different enough.
Yeah, totally. I think you're both right in that. Like, so we just did an episode on open world games about a week ago. And I, of course, spent a lot of time talking about how Breath of the Wild scratched this itch for me in a way that I had not expected it would. I'm not a big Zelda person historically. Like, I've enjoyed some Zelda games, but it's not like in my top 10 series or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then that game came out and just completely obliterated me.
Yes.
It turned me into a mewling child. Just filled with joy and beauty. And one of the responses I got was like, Austin is in full fanboy mode. Like, Austin is saying that stuff doesn't repeat. And, like, of course stuff repeats. You're right. Of course, it's always a Korok seed under the tree that you see in the distance. It's always...
Yeah.
You're right to say there is not as much unique stuff as in Skyrim, where the unique stuff can be a sword with fire versus a sword with ice versus a... Do you know what I mean? Like, but what I mean when I say that there isn't repetition is that I don't feel repetition. Yeah. The repetition that doesn't exist is the repetition that doesn't exist in my experience of play.
Yeah.
And... like you, Adam, to some degree, it is hard for me to square that against the kind of indifferent perspective that says like, oh yeah, there's a Korok seed under every rock. Like,
yeah.
It's always a Korok seed. I don't give a fuck though. In real life, when I'm playing that game, when I see the Korok seed, I go, yes, got a Korok seed. I'm not even gonna spend it at this point in my in my career. But it's the pleasure of recognizing the pattern in the world, of identifying a solution, of operating that, and then like sliding that into the ongoing adventure of Link and like the exploration of a space just feels so rewarding.
And I've often tried to figure out why in some games, and a lot of it, it's where I am in my life, but sometimes it's the game, and I don't know why, where, I buy a new game, everyone says this game is great, spend my $60, video games are the thing that I will spend any amount of money on, I just don't have a budget, right? Because on that level, it's not that expensive of a hobby, you know what I mean? Like, it's expensive, but, hey,
It's not a private jet.
Not a private jet.
It's not a golf club.
I'm not buying, you know, some people, they make a TV show, they buy a car. I don't buy a car. I spend $60 on a video game, right? So I have no problem doing that. And I'll load it up and be like, okay, great. But sometimes, you know, what is it about some games where I load them up and then I get to a quest giver and they're like, go do this. And I'm like, I don't want to
quest giver
fucking
voice.
Yeah. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. Why is it asking me to do that? Like, I don't really feel like that's a good use of my time. And then other games, I'm like, yes, I will.
Of course.
I want to. Like, yeah, I mean, like Zelda.
Anything you say, quest giver.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't figure it out. Like The Witcher, Witcher 3, I tried with twice. And, you know, I get that the world is beautiful and the story seems great, you know, like, definitely seems like better Skyrim in terms of like, we've got story and quest and like,
well, there's unicorn sex. That's everywhere. Most of it.
I'm trying to get into it. I'm like, nah, it's just, I'm not having that reaction. And Zelda is true. Breath of the Wild has less individual, you know, less individual quests in it, less mm-hmm. individual quest giver, less dialogue, less right. stories. Like, I remember the first time I played Skyrim in 2011, I was amazed by it because it was the first game I had played that had that much content where it was like, we made so much goddamn content. And like, you're like walking around and you're like, there's an obelisk and you walk up to it and a god talks to you. Yep. And the god is like, go do that. And I'm like, there's just hundreds of things like that in this game. Unbelievable. Right. And I was amazed. But now I'm bored by that. And Zelda has much less of that stuff. Like it's mostly Korok seats.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
But then you wander into the desert off the top of a mountain pass and you see 13 statues
yes.
in a circle in the distance.
Yeah. And you're like,
yeah.
What's that?
Thank you, Natalie.
Adventurer you. Voice. The Zelda
right.
voice.
Yeah, adventurer voice in my brain is just Natalie going,
well, it can
what's
be,
that?
It can be simpler than what those games do. I mean, I think Skyrim, maybe if I went back and played it now, I'd still be like, yes, this nailed it. And then like Fallout 4 didn't some reason I could pinpoint. But maybe you just don't need that much. That like all you really need is a lone tree on a hilltop and I'm going to be entranced.
Right.
Well, I mean,
right?
I think there's something so magical about the Zelda world that does it for me. Like, yeah. I don't know if it's the setting of the fact that what you kind of mentioned earlier about like wanting to slow progression and like wanting to just savor as much as possible, like opening up. I remember when I had, like you were saying, like, just a couple, like three areas left, and I like avoided them. Yeah. I was like, I don't want to go do this because I want to just like do everything in every single space, and just I want to know this map like it is my own world. Like, I want to feel a part of this world, and I want that like sort of like muscle memory almost just of this like being imprinted in me. And there is something that is so, like, not just wholesome, but I don't know what it was about Breath of the Wild that just like completely enraptured me in its character, in its charm, in its aesthetic, and everything that like I love fantasy bullshit. Like I love that shit. And with Skyrim, I just didn't grab on. Whereas other games like Dragon Age Inquisition is an example of one that's like not as open world as like Skyrim or those, but did grab onto me with its like storytelling and its environmental storytelling, and with like this like little sonnets or whatever, you know, like those like little irrelevant but relevant in air quotes pieces of content, capital whatever, were able to grab me. But in Skyrim, it felt like tired, or like I had already been here somehow.
Yeah, part of Skyrim might have been for me that I sort of was, for some reason, taking a break from games for like, there was like a 5 or 10 year period where I didn't play as many. I still had Nintendo systems, but I didn't play like AAA stuff. Mm-hmm. And then for whatever reason, this is actually a time in my life. This is before I worked at College Humor. I had gotten my first ever professional comedy writing gig on a VH1 sketch show that was very short lived. And I had to fly out to California to write on it. And I didn't even have a laptop. So I shipped my iMac. And then I was staying in a sublet in North Hollywood. Which is a whole story in itself. That was weird in a couple different ways. And I hated the job. And so I would go home and I literally had my iMac set up on a box on the box that it was shipped in on the floor.
Yep. Living the life. Honestly.
Living the life. Yes. But I had Skyrim. I installed Skyrim. And I believe I actually pirated it because I hadn't been paid yet. But
sounds right.
Shout
outs to a decade ago.
I think part of it was having that first AAA experience in a long time, but it was that feeling of here's a world I can go engage and be a hero and yeah. escape my life. But yeah, it has less. There's some purity to Zelda that other games don't even try to accomplish. Mm-hmm. It's also amazing. I've always been amazed by this, that like the people who the designers of Zelda and Mario Odyssey, how did they have a meeting where they were like, how do people play with the Switch? Well, it's portable, so it's in short bursts. So yeah. In this mega adventure, let's make sure that the main gameplay mechanic loop is based around short play yep. advancements so you can knock out shrines. So I would hold off. Well, I'm not going to go explore the new part of the map yet because I'm at work or I'm on set and I want to do that on my big screen TV at home. Mm-hmm. But I can go knock out a couple shrines, right?
Over my lunch break or yeah. whatever it is. Yeah, totally.
Which is so
good.
How
the answer is yes, I believe, right? The answer is absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is true for so many Nintendo systems in general. Yeah. As you look at the system, you look at the entire breadth of games available, and you're like, the system has a bunch of features that no one is using. Or like there is something about the system that feels absent in a lot of the third party games. And then in Nintendo's games, like, they got a lot out of this thing. They understand yeah. what the process of play is like on this device.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With Zelda in particular, one of the big things that they talked about during the lead up at, so like I think at the GDC talk, was that at every major milestone, they took a week off and sent everybody home. Took a week off, as I'm putting in air quotes. And also, we can't vouch for the labor policies of Nintendo necessarily.
Yeah.
But people went home and just played the game for a week.
Yeah.
And so I suspect that when the entire team is doing that, you get a lot of information on how people just genuinely use this device.
Yeah.
Are they using it on their couch? Are they using it in mass transit? Are they using it? Like, what does it look like for them?
Yeah.
And I think you're right. Like, I think it comes down to, like, they identified that this is a key way people are going to play the game is in 15-minute bursts. They're going to be on the toilet. They're going to be, like,
you got a 15-minute burst on that toilet. You know?
You got a 15-minute toilet burst. See a doctor.
Yeah. I'm worried.
Immediately.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I get so emotional when I talk about Nintendo. It's really, it's really funny. I, you know, it's a part of the Mind Parasite show that I'm working on that I didn't end up writing, but it was going to be about, it's like the cutting room floor part.
Yeah,
but
it was the true material.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Please.
It was going to be about brand loyalty and about like pop culture loyalty and the way in which, like, why does Disney buy every IP, right? They buy it because, like, if you look at the way, like, Star Wars is marketed, the way people use it, people raise their kids on Star Wars. I have friends who are doing that, right? So it's essentially a perpetual revenue source, you know? And even people who don't like the new movies go see them, you know? And it's embedded in their hearts and minds from such a young age that they can't not love it. It's a part of them forever. And that's how I am with Nintendo. And because I just grew,
and it doesn't
I just
matter
up
that you know
it.
This. That is the thing about culture, right?
Yeah,
this
I
is
can't
like
get
one
out
of the
it.
Yeah. One of the things that there's a philosopher who's always bugged me. There's a philosopher who I have relied on a lot, which is Louis Althusser, who is someone who's like, here is how ideology functions. Here, the ideological state apparatus creates the sorts of people it needs to keep the machine of the state running, right? Oh, okay, schools exist to produce the sorts of personalities necessary to continue to operate
prisons and police and teaching and, you know, to have people grow up to become garbage men and also to grow up to become sales executives.
I have a hard time believing our school system is that organized.
It's not. But... Well, he doesn't think it is organized. He doesn't think it's like people are deciding this. Yeah. He thinks systems perpetuate themselves.
Go this way.
Yeah. Right. But he's like, but I, the social scientist, am above all of that.
I'm
like, Louis, all right, motherfucker. First of all, like real talk, Louis Althusser, you killed your wife, my guy.
Oh, wow.
So maybe you are not outside of the system that perpetuates terrible things. Two, it's fucked up that we in our positions can be like, I know how brands work and how they leverage loyalty in an irrational way. And also, I absolutely teared up at the end of The Last Jedi when Luke is looking at out at the two fucking suns.
Yeah.
And that's like, oh, wow, this thing has been in me for 32 years and 30, whatever old I was at the time. And it can't, I can't get it out.
Yeah.
It's just there.
It's part of you.
It's a mind parasite.
But as it's a mind parasite. Exactly. You don't have a choice. But that's why it's so rewarding what Nintendo has done over the last couple of years, because like when like I had a Wii U and I would like stand for the Wii U and be like, this is a good system, and hey, I still think it's worth the purchase. It's still worth it. Was, at the time, it was still worth the purchase.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
They were a good.
I'm here with you.
Hey,
I'm
Breath
here.
Of the Wild. I played 222 hours of Breath of the Wild on my Wii U.
Right.
Also, on that Wii U.
Also, so many Splatoon and Captain Toad and Pikmin 3. Tropical,
they were doing great experiments on that.
Pikmin 3
and Mario Maker,
like, Zombie U.
Yes.
They're great games on the system.
So, but at the same time, I was like, if Nintendo just started sending me fundraising emails that were like, hey, would you chip in $20 to make sure Nintendo's still around? I would fucking do it.
Join Nintendo's Patreon.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It matters to me. And and part of it is because it's like, it's the fucking Willy Wonka factory. Like it is a special creative culture that doesn't exist elsewhere. And that is shown in the Renaissance that they've had, that like, God, I was just like, I don't want Disney to buy Nintendo. I don't want Disney to buy Nintendo.
You see, Apple is poised to, or like there was a news report today that Apple is like considering buying Nintendo.
That's been a rumor for a long
years.
Time.
Has that?
Like, I'm curious. Yeah.
I mean, but and it's kind of the nice thing about, well, here's the thing. Nintendo is such a weird company, right? Like, I don't know if you guys know Mike Drucker. He's
Mike's great.
He wrote on our show for a year. He's a good friend of mine.
Used
to work for Nintendo.
Great Twitter presence.
Fantastic.
Oh my God.
He's great. And he was just like, I think he was working with me like when the NES Classic shortage happened.
Right.
You know? And I was like, man, what's going on here? And he's like, look, I talked to my friends and apparently what happened, I can say that he told me this probably. Should I say it? I don't know. He told me, here's what the real reason
was. A little birdie said.
There was a supply chain problem
that
wasn't their fault, you know?
That's what their official word is also.
Yeah.
Oh, it was. Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah. They don't throw anybody. They weren't.
Okay. Never mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Then I'm misremembering this story. Anyway, I was like, why don't they tell people this? And he said, it's because they're weird.
They
like,
did eventually. What happened was they eventually told people.
Yeah, okay.
Way later, when people were like, when the Super Nintendo Classic was coming out, they were like, last time was a supply problem.
Yeah.
We're not. I know this because Reggie sat in a room with me and said, Austin.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
We got Reggie's word.
They could have said it at the time, right?
Right.
And totally. And they would have saved so much bad press. And but it's like, it's the Willy Wonka's chocolate factory thing.
Show anybody anything.
Yeah. And that's what's great about it, is that they are a corporation that exists within capitalism that doesn't make the decisions that corporations are supposed to make.
Right.
Right. In order to maximize profits. And they do a bad job of it a lot of the time. But as a result, they produce things that are weird and strange. And sometimes they let you down. And they have this chunkiness that, like, I can only imagine. I remember when Disney started buying all this IP, right? Mm-hmm. They bought the Muppets and they bought Star Wars, right? And those Muppet movies started coming out that people started liking. And I was like, okay, well, be careful what you wish for here, right? Because it used to be that when there was a brand that you liked, like say you were an MST3K fan. Well, guess what? It was mismanaged by the networks and now it doesn't exist anymore. And every little glimpse of it you get is precious, right? And the good ones are precious, right? But now that Disney has it, guess what? Here's a new Muppets movie every year until you die and they're all going to be okay, right?
Yeah.
It didn't happen so much with the Muppets. It is happening with Star Wars, right? It's absolutely, and the Marvel movies, you know? And so that's great.
Marvel's
but
a good pull there, yeah.
It evens it all out, you know? It's even quality level. But Nintendo... Guess what? I love Metroid. There's only been like two good Metroid games ever. Super Metroid was good. Metroid Prime was good. The rest are okay to bad, right? Oh, Metroid.
Send your letters.
Fusion. No, I didn't like Fusion. But like,
what is your account?
I think the first one's actually pretty
good. Just Metroid. You like NES Metroid.
NES Metroid. I'm not gonna say
it's
bad.
It's pretty good.
It's hard to play by modern standards.
It's not. It's not the easiest thing to go into.
The ideas were in there.
They were in there. Yeah.
But so like Nintendo actually, and I was talking to Drucker about this. I was like, "What's the deal with Metroid?" He's like, "Well, actually, the problem is the Japanese side of the company doesn't understand the property because it's more popular in the U.S." This is his theory anyway.
Yeah.
So they give it to developers that don't understand it to make the games. They like
Team Ninja. Other M
They support Zero Suit Samus, which if you're my kind of Metroid fan, you're like, I don't like Zero Suit Samus. That's not my Samus, right? Hashtag not my Samus.
Right.
Oh God.
So and that means that when a good Metroid comes out, you're like, oh, you know, it means so much. And so it's chunky. It's chunky because they don't always make the decision they're supposed to make, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Breath of the Wild means more because Skyward Sword sucked, right?
and then it had real problems.
And suddenly it's magical. Where are these great games coming from? I don't even know because they don't even let the devs give interviews.
Well, that
you know?
Is like, so again, like that's one of those things I talked to Reggie about. I was like, let us come there and shoot film and interview people. And he's like, Austin, they won't let us come there and shoot film.
Yeah.
Well, that's not exactly what he said. But the gist of it was like, they, to some degree, there's a degree to which it feels like they just want to do the work. They just want to make stuff. They don't want to show people the way it's happening. And as someone who's interested in games as a medium, that's frustrating because I think it's important that we understand how great art is made, but I also do understand that perspective as someone who's like, I just want to do the work. Please just let me do the work. Yeah. I don't, the idea of like someone like watching my screen as I'm typing a review makes me terrified. I would hate it.
But they keep you at arm's length in this weird way. Like Drucker also told me that at the Redmond headquarters, there's like a Nintendo museum that only Nintendo employees can go to.
There's a shop. I just talked to a friend of mine about this. There is a gift shop. There is like a Nintendo store in Redmond at their HQ, but you can, it's behind closed doors.
Yeah.
So it's literally just for Nintendo employees.
And I went to Japan a year or two ago. And when I was there, I was like, why is there no Nintendo thing I can go to? We were in Kyoto. I didn't even go look at the headquarters because I know it's just a building
I
can't go in.
Yeah.
But then by contrast, when you get a glimpse, like I went to the Nintendo store in New York a couple years ago, and I forget why, but in a corner, almost just small, there wasn't anyone else around. There was just this little display, and in the display was a handwritten... it was Miyamoto's original level design on loose leaf paper for Super Mario Brothers. It was either World 1-1 or World 1-2 on graph paper.
Right.
And I was like, why the fuck is this here?
This should be in the Smithsonian.
It should be. It's like one of the most valuable, historically valuable video game artifacts possible to exist, and it was just sitting in the store. There wasn't a sign. There wasn't a line.
Who's guarding it?
Yeah,
it was National Treasure 3. McCain is gonna steal it. No
there's
problem.
There's a map on the bottom, on the back of this piece of graph paper of World 1-1.
Yeah.
So it's just like that's
was
what
there
makes
even a
me
plaque?
Love it. Yeah, there was a little plaque that like described what it was, but it was just like, hey, here's a celebration of Mario, you know, but mostly it's just people buying Pokemon hats, right?
Right, right. Which, no shame, Pokemon hats are cool.
Yeah. Agreed.
True.
But you know, you go to, and when you go to Tokyo, you go to Akihabara, I can't pronounce it right, but you know, there's a Sega thing, there's no Nintendo thing. What's going on?
How better could you differentiate the Sega and Nintendo ideologies, philosophies than that in the mid 90s and early 2000s, Sega did everything possible to create Sega World and to create Sega branded arcades and to be everywhere and to put Sonic everywhere.
Yeah.
Not that Nintendo didn't do its own like
Mario had some cereal.
Had some cereal. Pikachu. Mario had a movie. Pikachu. Yeah. Well, okay. We're moving into the world of Detective Pikachu now. So maybe everything's about to change.
See, that's...
Detective
I'm here
for
Pikachu
it, dude.
Pikachu is the first... No. I don't have a problem with it.
Okay.
What is amazing about it is that it's the first Nintendo feature film, like, in solo... Oh, I guess they do the Pokemon movies and stuff.
Right.
But still, like,
Since the Mario Brothers.
Theatrical.
Yeah.
I think the first Pokemon movie got a theatrical release, right?
2000. Pokemon 2000 was in theaters.
God, 2000, though.
Oh, the year you were born.
Yeah, you got the... Yeah. That's when I was born. And when I was born, actually, what they gave me was the gold Mewtwo. Pokemon card.
Right, like just
the day you were born.
The day I was born. Wow. And that was my silver spoon, you know?
Wow. Gotcha.
But yeah, anyway, if I'll join that Patreon any day, you know?
Shout out to Nintendo.
Just to have that stuff keep existing, you know? But yeah, they've got me. I mean, here's the thing. If it sucked, if the game sucked, I would still be buying them, right?
Do you think that would never break for you? Is this part of the Mind Parasite? Is that there is no eject? There's nothing that would get you off this brand train.
I think if like Disney bought it and started doing stuff I didn't like, probably because my allegiance is not just to the characters. It's like to something like it's like literally allegiance to the company. Mm-hmm. You know, like I have all my old issues of Nintendo Power in a special box. You know, like it's to the company itself.
Is this something you think changes in a world where we do start to learn more about developers? Not only because we learn about mm-hmm. labor conditions, but also because I think about something like, I mean, real talk, we can talk about Vice, right? Like, Desus and Mero had a huge audience while they had a show at Vice. They are now at Showtime. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people who are like, fuck Vice now.
Yeah.
We're going to stick with, the brand is strong. We're going to stay with Desus and Mero, and they're going to go to Showtime. And I'm curious, like, we see a little bit of that in games with something like Hideo Kojima, who the audience turned real quick on Konami.
Yeah.
Less so for the allegations of labor abuse there, and more because people were upset with what happened with Metal Gear Solid 5 and with Hideo Kojima, and are now like, yes, we're on the Kojima train wherever he goes. Do you think we'll see more of that in the future as stuff changes?
I mean, if there's more auteurs, but it requires an auteur, right? Because then people have an association with Hideo Kojima. I mean, I don't have a strong association with Hideo Kojima. I know people who do, but you know, and I get it, but yeah, I mean, when people have that connection to the particular developer, I'm trying to think of an example of a developer I loved who's gone from one place to another, but
I can't even imagine like any of the auteurs of Nintendo leaving.
Well, you don't know who they are.
Other than Miyamoto.
Well, I mean, Miyamoto. Yeah. There's Iwata. There's. Yeah.
There was Iwata.
Oh,
I was actually in Kyoto the day he died.
Even the Zelda producer whose name I don't.
Aonuma.
Oh yeah,
Aonuma.
There's Sakurai. Yeah.
Sakurai is pretty close. If Sakurai left, you could imagine the Smash. If he got booted out and he was like, I'm doing my own Smash, my indie Smash, people would go for that, right? But Aonuma from Zelda, I don't think of him as being an auteur. He's like I don't know that much about
no,
the team.
No, I think that's.
But he directed the bad games too, right? Or he produced the bad games.
I don't know enough of the Zelda series to know.
I believe he's led that franchise
part
the whole
of the
time,
thing, right?
You know?
Yeah, totally.
But you know, my understanding is the reason those games are good is there's been some kind of sea change at Nintendo where the old people left and now there's young folks who are like sort of designing games in a new way. Yeah. And that's why you have this breath of fresh life with Splatoon and Mario and Zelda. That's what I've heard. But you don't, you know, they keep it a little bit more anonymous because you can't do that as well.
Anytime I've had the pleasure of interviewing Nintendo devs, which is always like a very, you know, because obviously you're going through a translator, there's a whole sort of process with it. It's never going to feel necessarily like the way, oh, with an indie dev, I can sit there for 4 hours and hear everything, you know, that's kind of going on. Every time I have done sort of one of those interviews, it has always been very, very exciting on the sort of design end. And mm-hmm. they love talking about that. They love talking about sort of the new people who come in and have ideas. For example, I talked to the folks who made Captain Toad at the time, and they were so excited to show, like, they had visual aids. They were like, we started with the garden in a box idea of Mario 64, and they sort of show, like, the Mario 64 Japanese N64, like, cover and things like that. They get so excited and so into it, and they've always talked about the passion of fans who grew up fans and then went to work at Nintendo, who became designers there, who have ideas for mechanics, and actually that some of them have been so into the nostalgia that they've had to be told, like, all right, don't overdo this. We don't need Karibo's shoe in like every level, because they're just too excited. They're like, oh my God, what if I could put this in every level? Because now I work at Nintendo, which I always thought was like the cutest sort of thing.
But that feeling like the Mind Parasite, the thing the most that gets me the most, right, was when I remember when Smash 4 for Wii U came out and they announced the Duck Hunt dog that was going to be in the game. And I literally was like, they remembered, you know, like it was personally important to me because as a kid, we had the Duck Hunt dog. We all tried to shoot the Duck Hunt dog. You can't shoot him. You have this particular identification of the Duck Hunt dog, and then no more Duck Hunt dog.
Right.
For like 30 years, you know, 25 years or so, just never comes
up
again.
That dog lived a whole other life. That dog had a family.
It just exists.
So many puppies.
Yeah. It just exists in, you know, college humor and dorkly sketches that we would write. And like, you know, oh, hey, remember the Duck Hunt dog?
Someone's Twitter avatar.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but then they're like, no, we didn't forget. We remember the Duck Hunt dog too, and here it is. And guess what? He looks exactly like the Duck Hunt dog did. It's just so much. Like, another one that did this for me was like Smash, the new Smash with Simon Belmont in it. I had just played, because I got an NES Classic, I played the original Castlevania, which I never played. I played a lot of Castlevania 3, but I never played the original. I was like, I'm going to play the original, and had a very fun time. The way they have animated Simon Belmont to have the exact same walk cycle as the NES 8-bit, which was like 3 frames of animation and like 16 pixels by 16 pixels, and now they've got a perfectly rendered 3D guy, but he's exactly the same, is unbelievable. And it's just this resonance that you don't get to have without having a relationship with this company for your whole life. It's like such a weirdly deep artistic experience. So that's what I'm saying. Like, again, I'm getting emotional talking about my relationship with this fucking company.
That's serious.
I guess it's just that it's deep. So rare. Like when Nintendo, because we're like, as Nintendo fans, we're constantly reaching out to Nintendo. Like, we're like, please, 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 just anything. And they're like, here's a breadcrumb of Simon Belfont being very well animated. And you're like, delicious. I love it. One more breadcrumb, please. And they're like, here's a Snake in fucking Smash. And you're just like, yes, thank you. And you're so grateful. And like, that's only, I feel like, well, also with Dragon Age Inquisition, I think I have that relationship with.
I certainly do.
But that's the thing. It's like, we're constantly pushed up against, right? Because anytime fans try to do things with Nintendo, like, they are shut down. They are sent, you know, cease and desist when there's fan-made games and things like that. And that's why this, like, relationship is so strange, because we're still like grateful. We're like, even with the SNES and the emulator they chose to use, that was like made by,
it was like a fan. Was it the SNES Classic that had that too? I know the I
know the PlayStation Classic used
definitely
a fan
did this, yeah.
Made emulator
after sending a cease and desist to like take it down.
Well, and the NES and Nintendo just did also send those cease and desist.
There was a thing about their virtual console game.
That's like, what it was.
Was it Frank Cifaldi? Was that the guy?
Frank is the one who figured out
that it was a ROM. An online ROM that someone had ripped or something.
Right.
That was his conclusion.
Yeah. And if I would trust somebody, it would be Frank Cifaldi, who knows everything about retro games and has made video game history his life's work.
Yeah, and it's such a bummer that they that's the bad side of the Willy Wonka effect, right? Is that the destruction of video game history that constitutes those ROM sites being taken down is, you know, you can't get through to them to explain that, right?
It's one of those things that's there's such a fascinating tension, because the only way you get something like Kaizo Mario or any of the things that would inspire Mario Maker to exist one day is to have fans disregard copyright law.
Yeah.
And say, no, I'm going to hack this. I'm going to make this something else. I'm going to share this online. I'm going to build a community because I love Mario so much. I love the basic verbs you've given me. Mm-hmm. I love the language you've taught me. I want to make something in this language without working for you. I'm not trying to make money on it. I'm just trying to like have fun with my friends. But copyright law being what it is, like, does not allow for that.
Right.
And Nintendo is, of the brands who are defensive of their IP, Nintendo is very defensive and protective of their IP. And it's just like, there is such a, this dance is not going anywhere until copyright law changes, which good luck.
Yeah.
Well, there's been a small, like, little chink in the, you know, in the wall, in that, you know, we did a segment on our show years ago about, you know, the extensions to the copyright acts that kept being passed. And then this was the first year that they weren't passed, right? That Disney didn't lobby to extend copyright by another 25 years. Yeah. So now things are entering the public domain for the first time ever, which is really wonderful. And maybe is a little bit of a sign that
I hope it's going that way. It's like, I want to live in the world in which Mario fan games are just things that exist in the same way that
Sherlock Holmes films are a thing that exist. Do you right. know what I mean? Anyone yes. can play with Sherlock Holmes. We could make a Sherlock Holmes movie right now, and yeah. it could be great. Maybe yeah. not right now. We are in a recording. We are in Control Room B in the basement yeah. of Vice.
Well, that's the mystery.
But right, you're right.
You know?
How do we get out? But
how do we leave?
I do genuinely think that there's a period of time at which these things moving into the public domain and becoming part of the palette for creators to use would help break that brand effect.
Right.
But for these things, I mean, with something like Mario, it will happen at the very end of our lifetimes.
Yes.
Even if laws don't change at all
yeah.
forever. You know what I mean?
I've always hoped that these companies will realize, you know, the most perverse thing about Disney lobbying to extend copyright laws is that they make their money off of public domain, right? That, like, a Hunchback of Notre Dame is, okay, yep. great, we can do that, you know.
Cinderella, like, all yeah. these are old.
Little Mermaid,
But you'd hope that the entertainment industry, of which I am a part, but I don't have any influence over this part of it, but they would say, like, yeah, hey, it's pretty good for us that we can do Sherlock Holmes every single year, yeah. right? We can do the Will Ferrell Sherlock Holmes. We can do the
Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock
yeah, thank
Holmes.
You, the Robert Downey yeah. Jr. We can do all the different versions of it.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Yeah,
all of them.
Right, yeah. like
Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch on TV at the same time, yep. both yes. the Sherlock properties.
Exactly.
Doing and well.
Totally different takes yep. on it, right? You get to choose which Sherlock, hashtag not my Sherlock.
Hashtag not my Sherlock.
I mean, that's how I felt about the, I was like, I don't want American Sherlock. What are we doing? You know, I love the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock. But they have a voracious appetite for needing more properties yeah. like this, right?
Yeah.
And so you would hope that they would figure out, like, oh yeah, we need a robust public domain so that there, because the, having things that the public knows about that anyone can make a new creative property based on is, like, pretty valuable for
yeah,
everybody.
Totally. You know? I guess the alternative is they're terrified that things that are currently in their portfolio
yeah.
are less in their portfolio, right? Yeah. Things that they can bank on forever will not be there tomorrow.
And that's why Disney collecting all of these right. properties together is such a – I mean, people remark on it, but, like, I think in terms of that strategy, I feel like did not get the amount of attention that it deserved in terms of, like, how much they're like, yeah, we are anything that has this structure, right, where there's all these characters, all these stories, and people have, like, a deep down allegiance to it, you know, hasn't. That is, like, what they're going for. And that's why, if the Switch hadn't taken off, the Nintendo would be
right.
subsidiary 57 of the Disney Corporation by now. If the Switch had been a flop, it yeah. would already be done, in my opinion. So
could happen. We could see one day in our lives.
Oh, God. I really
or
Mario
one day.
World.
Yeah.
Oh,
part of the Disney empire.
Well, isn't Mario World coming?
Yeah, I think there is there a
Universal
Mario?
Actually has Universal, a deal.
But they scaled, I just read they scaled down a bunch of it yeah. because they thought that there was going to be a Zelda section and another section. They were like, nah, that's too much. We'll just do the Mario. And I don't trust Universal. I want Nintendo to build a theme park themselves.
Okay, you really want, like, the same design. You want game designers yeah. to
yes.
go in. That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want
someone who gets the magic, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about Disney, right, is even when you criticize Disney, you know, creative culture, you know, Imagineers, magic making, they've got that gear. Nintendo right. has that gear as well. It's the Willy Wonka effect. But I don't think Universal does.
You know? I'll say their Harry Potter stuff. Pretty rad.
Oh, people do love that Harry
that
Potter
That is pretty
world.
Good in terms of, like, theming and sort of immersion
yeah,
in terms
true.
of what's going on with that. However, I think that only came because our best friend, J.K. Rowling, actually was that obsessed with every yeah. detail. Universal theme parks. I have a theory, if I may.
Please.
I've been to Walt Disney World and Universal Studios more than 50 times. That was one of those.
Oh, wow.
My mom is obsessed. She is a Disney World fanatic. Uh-huh. So been to a lot of it. But a lot of the Universal rides are fun and they're cool, but it feels like going to a theme park. Whereas Disney, they are obsessed with details. And this is why Disney and J.K. Rowling didn't work out. Originally, that was going to be where her park was. Whatever she owns at this point. Mm-hmm. Harry Potter World was going to be at Disney, but they were both such obsessive, compulsive, you know, fanatics about yeah. every last detail. It wasn't going to work out. That marriage was not good. But of course, Universal
She's
was like yeah, come on over. We'll do whatever you want.
She's like, I need the ability to decide the robots are retroactively gay.
Yes. That's what it was. That's what she said. And Disney was like, I don't know about that,
I don't know
JK.
About, okay, JK.
JK, I don't know.
All right.
We have gay days. That's enough.
Do they have gay days at Disney now?
They do.
Yeah,
there's a pride
yeah.
day. They actually really do.
Yeah.
I remember there's a lot of queer families at Disney
yeah,
for
yeah,
one
I
week.
I would imagine.
It's pride day nice. Was also on, like, Raver Day. Last time I was there.
You know, Raver Pride?
It was Raver Pride Day last time.
Hashtag not my pride. To be clear, Raver Pride. Gay Pride here for.
Yes.
The thing that is so tough about all the things we're talking about is that, like, you talk about, like, the Imagineers at Disney, you talk about the designers at Nintendo. It is, I think this is actually really interesting inside of the world of games specifically. I think you look at the world of music, you look at the world of comedy, you look at comics even. There is a set of creators and fans who are entirely disengaged with the popular culture machine in those industries, right? They are, like, you know, watching independent film that people like you and I may not even hear about for years until it breaks into, like, the canon retroactively because that director goes on to create something that has a crossover success. Mm-hmm. And everyone tells you, oh, well, you have to go back and watch blah, blah, blah that only did the festival circuit or whatever. Same thing with music. People who are only listening to artists who are not signed to any major label, who maybe don't even have Bandcamp accounts, right?
Yeah.
But in games, while you do have people, and I can think of great critics who follow those spaces really well, follow non-commercial games, follow alt games, follow truly independent stuff, almost everyone still burns a candle for a Nintendo or for a Dark Souls or for a there are crossover things that, like, I don't know anyone in this space. I'm sure they exist. You don't have to write in. Though if you write in, you're listening to us, which means you are a part of the same mainstream space to some degree. No one is fully detached from it. And so there's a lot of incredible creative people who are doing their best work for big, often faceless corporations, lining the pockets and the coffers of those corporations, and whose work you as a fan and a critic want to celebrate and do celebrate, yet also must tangle with the beast and the machine.
Yeah.
I could not quit my job today or decide that Waypoint only is covering alternative or independent non-commercial games, and Waypoint would continue to exist. It would not exist anymore, partially because lots of our fans, many of whom are indie game creators, are interested in our take on Sekiro, which is coming out in 2 months, or on Anthem, both of which are gigantic games being published by gigantic companies.
Yeah.
It is such an interesting moment in games because of that. And I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon because of the marriage that games have between technology and entertainment industries.
Yeah, and you know, my one disappointment for the Humans Who Make Games podcast is I really tried to find somebody from, like, a AAA space who I could talk to, and it was just like... you know, I think next season we're going to give it another whack because it's just hard to get through PR people, you know.
Sure.
I was, like, tangoing with a couple places. But I really want to talk to, well, I won't say who, but there was someone I want to talk to who I knew from her more indie, not indie, but I knew from her more, like, sort of auteur-y work where her name was associated with the work. And now she's more with a AAA place. Mm. And I was like, I just want to know what that's like, you know, to make the transition from one to the other. And, like, what is it like to work in that larger company? Because that's the story, you know. I had a blast talking to Derek Yu and Ben McMillan because it was, you know, very fun conversations and, like, really fun to hear about that, you know, how you go from... You know, how you, like, make a whole game all by yourself. But, like, what is it like to work on, you know, a Blizzard game? Actually, one of the people from Game Workers Unite did work for a AAA studio that we did not name. But we did get some of that perspective just in a very anonymous way.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean... it's just interesting. We don't get that perspective that much of, like, here's what it's like to be in the machine.
You know, you look at something like Ubisoft where 900, 800, 1,000 people work on a game. What is that experience like? You know, I know off the record from people, but I also know off the record from a handful of people, not from all 800 and not from someone who has a perspective that connects different parts of those studios together. Like, there are so many stories to tell still about the way games come together, and I just hope we get to keep telling them.
Yeah. Especially considering, like, the experiences of now, like, so many different studios, like, geographically making up one game and, like, having the inaccessibility to some of those studios that are outside of the US or outside of Europe or whatever is a lot. And there's a reason why it's difficult to get into those. There has to be.
The one that comes to mind is, you know, you look at Jason Schreier's reporting on Rockstar last year, and even he was like, I have no idea what's up with Rockstar India. I cannot get anyone to talk to me about Rockstar India.
Yeah.
I don't know what the work is that is being done there.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, good question. I would love to know.
Yeah, whereas we know, like, specifically the QA is done in the one of the studios in
Scotland, I think.
And then, like, they're very, you know, upfront about certain things, which makes you question why they're not upfront about others. Like, that there is a lot of, I can't help but to be, you know, cynical about the unknown in game development.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. One thing I am curious about, and this is something I love to hear. I know we're probably wrapping up here, so this might be a big question, and you can kind of, like, you know, throw it back.
No, sure.
You can, like, do the tennis thing if it sucks. but one thing I do like to ask creatives in general is how not to become cynical. How do you keep your joy? How do you keep interested in the work that you do, even when you're working so hard? And not just work-life balance, but how do you stay interested in the world, especially when you're working on a show that kind of uncovers some, like, really ugly truths about the world, right?
Well, you know, I'm in a very privileged position because, you know, I'm kind of the luckiest person in America, I feel like, because I create a TV show with my name on it that I have almost completely unfettered creative control over. You know, the only constraints are my own constraints and, like, a half dozen conversations with the network, you know, and we're actually doing an episode, our season finale at the end of the, it's going to come out in months and months, but is called Adam Ruins Himself. And we actually, the network went so far as to let me do a segment about the compromises that the show has had to make with advertisers in order to put the show on the air.
Amazing.
So we talk about the times that, you know, I've had to, hey, this is a company that advertises on the network and, you know, but you're talking about them on the show and here's what has to happen. Right. So that's an incredibly lucky position to be in. And so all of my problems are, like, related to burnout and stuff like that. And even before that, at College Humor, you know, that was a little bit of a writer's paradise where not all your sketches got picked up, but once you wrote it and it was picked up, hey, that was your...
It got made.
Yeah, it got made. So, you know, I haven't had the experience of working in a place that's a grind where I don't get to put my own shit up and, you know, which I'm sure is what it's like to work at many roles at Vice or many roles at Ubisoft or whatever. I just try to make the very most of that I can every day. My overall perspective, you know, being that even though the show is so cynical, even though so many of the topics have a tendency to make you cynical, is, you know, ultimately I think the show is a very positive message that, like I said at the beginning, where it, you know, you are more empowered the more you know. It's always better to know. And the show is driven by my own curiosity to find these things out. So, you know, as long as I'm able to find amazement in the next topic, I'm able to keep going. By the way, can I talk about what the episode we have coming up?
Yes, please do. You pitched it to me and we have not gotten to it yet.
Let's do it.
I just want to talk about it really quick. Yeah. The next episode, if anybody is, for people who are still tuning, I don't know what your graph looks like.
It looks good. It's not bad. It's people honestly listen. Not bad.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. So for everybody tuning in, next Tuesday at 10 p.m. on True TV, we've got, we're doing an episode called, the episode is called Adam Ruins Games. And I should have said that at the beginning.
Oh my God.
It fits for you, right? everybody in True PR is like, God damn it, he's waiting for hour five to plug the fucking show. It's called Adam Ruins Games. The three segments we're doing are, I just want to tell you guys about one of them because I'm excited about it. The first one is about, it's about violent video games don't cause violence, which is very, I'm sure you guys, everyone, listening to this is on board,
but a broader audience
we totally destroy that, dude. It is a very fun segment. But the second segment, I'm really excited about the history of Monopoly. Do you guys know the history of Monopoly?
A little bit.
I do, actually.
You do?
You picked, like, the one room of people who know this story.
God damn
but
it.
Tell our audience.
I just knocked the mic box off the
okay.
This room is punchy.
We told you.
Have you ruined the mic stand?
Can I tell you why I only know it? Because I had to take a games history class.
Okay,
in so this college.
Is, yes, of course. All you people took games history classes.
I teach one. Yeah. But tell it. Yeah, tell
you both taught it.
Well, now I don't want it to. Kata, do you know it?
Yeah.
Fuck.
But there's
say, I need to tell you, you DM'd me about it. You seemed so excited.
You told me not to do it.
No. I was like, maybe it won't come up. I don't want to be the person who's like, so Adam DM'd me. I was like, what should we talk about? You're like, I'm doing this episode. Adam Ruins Games. Like, oh, wow. Adam Ruins Games. What are your stories? You're like, oh, da-da-da-da.
Violence. Of course you know all the stories.
And you're like, oh, Sequins of Monopoly. Monopoly has an incredible history. I'm like, yeah. And, but I didn't want to. But here we are. Our audience might not know it.
It is unknown.
It is an unknown. It is a
less. You're the only audience for me in the room.
Well, okay.
We'll react.
We're actors. We can do this. All right.
We're in
Austin is on Disney Channel.
Yeah, I was on Disney
XD. Danielle's on Disney Channel.
Do you want that or do you want. The third act is about the Olympics. Like, I do the Olympics instead. You prefer the Olympics?
Is it just like the Olympics are fucked? Is that the
Yeah, of course.
Give us Monopoly.
I like that.
Okay, the history of Monopoly. This is so.
It's been a while since I took the exam. Yeah, I bet there's shit that I got wrong. Okay. I didn't get 100% on that shit, so.
Well, okay, here's how we pitch it. The history of Monopoly. Okay, first of all, one of my favorite, we don't get into this in the show. Okay. One of my favorite things about Monopoly is that all the house rules that everybody uses to play Monopoly with are putting the money under go, right?
Sure.
And ignoring the auction rule. You know the auction rule?
What is the auction rule?
You don't know the auction rule. So the auction rule is, I remember reading the auction rule in the instruction booklet, but being like, weird, nobody plays with that. I guess I won't either. The auction rule is if you go past, if a property, if someone has the opportunity to buy it, but either doesn't have the money or chooses not to buy it, it goes up to auction, right? And everybody can bid on it. This changes everything. That's in the instruction manual.
What?
That's in the instruction manual, and nobody does.
I have to call my lawyer. I will be back.
Go to your parents' house. Look in the closet. Open the box. Look in the instruction manual. It'll have the auction rule in it, right? And it also won't have putting $200 under jail. Sorry,
under jail.
I never did that. Under free parking.
It's free parking. It's like, oh, if you land on free parking. Yeah. Take that money. Mm.
And so those two rules and other house rules that people play with are exactly why the game is too long, which is everybody's complaint. Oh, Everybody says Monopoly is too long. And because people don't play with the auction rule, which means properties go out faster and it's easier to get the properties you need, right? And because the putting money under free parking causes more money to sluice around, causing the game to be longer. So people's dumb
We've
house
ruined
rules.
People Monopoly. Have
people ruined it.
Yeah, and if you actually play, I've been with friends with that. Like, let's play Monopoly. I'm like, okay, but we're playing by the actual rules, and they're like, no, Adam, no, I won't play with my fun house rules. I'm like, you're wrong. Let's play this way. And then at the end, they're begrudgingly like, okay, your way's better. So that's the first thing.
That's good. That's new.
We got a little the sound in the room? Control room. We got.
I told you this
control room haunted.
We usually have to tell our story. We have to focus.
Yeah,
Adam, look
this.
At me.
Okay.
Focus
the
on
second
me.
Second part.
Don't watch the movie that is on TV that has the audio. There's a boob on screen.
It's Heather Graham. It's Heather Graham, and there's a boob. Yep.
Yeah, there's Heather Graham's boob on screen. It's very strange.
It's The Hangover.
It's The Hangover.
Everyone.
Got it.
That is.
Ed Helms only has one tooth. Okay. So the story about Monopoly is that the original version of Monopoly is called the Landlord's Game. It was created by this woman named Lizzie Magee, and it was created as a socialist teaching tool.
Yes.
And there were two sets of rules for the game. One is the set of rules that you know, which are, you know, basically the Monopoly that you grew up with. The other set of rules was called there's the Monopolist rules and the other set of the rules.
Find out on True TV.
Find out on True TV. The prosperity rules is what they were called. And what that happened was when you got a property or when you collected rent, you also gave some to other people, right?
Mm.
And the point was to show that private property and rent taking and the capitalist system leads to a condition in which one person wins and everybody loses,
right?
Mm. That's what happens in the game. So that's what you observe. But under the prosperity rules, everybody benefits, right? And all the boats rise together,
right?
And so it was intended as like a rhetorical teaching tool, which is really interesting because that is a style of game that has become in vogue in the last 10 years,
right?
Where people create teaching games. Let me show you what was the name of the game where, you know, here's what it's like to be like a poor street vendor. You know what I mean?
Cart life.
Yeah. Or like that sort of, you know, that sort of slice of life game. Let me show you how this, you know, you're now in this situation. Right. And but then the game sort of became a folk game and was picked up by this dude named Charles Darrow, who is credited as right. the inventor of Monopoly. He just was just like, oh, what's this game? Ooh, let me sell it to Parker Brothers. But he only sold the Monopolist rules. So he left out the other half of the teaching tool. Mm. And then that became the version which was popular. And Parker Brothers wrote Lizzie Maggie out of the history,
right.
which ultimately proved her point that in capitalism, one person wins and everybody else loses. She lost and he won.
And he wins. Right. Yeah. And this is what Althusser means when he says that the system creates what it needs to sustain itself. only the monopolist version of that and that becomes it's still a teaching tool. That is the thing to remember.
Yeah.
It is still a teaching tool. It is just not one that is an explicit teaching tool. But when I am 7 years old, desperate to beat my dad at Monopoly and prove that I am an adult, even though I'm only seven, that I can run my own life. Damn it. What I mean is I can make money. I can make smart investments, et cetera.
Yeah, it's Shark Tank for kids. Absolutely. You know? And it works really well, but it's like very fascinating as this microcosm of the same point that it was trying to prove. You know?
How does the prosperity rules even end? Like, how do you get to, is there an end state? Is that the point that everyone is just like, we're happy?
I'm actually not sure. Because
everyone's got money.
I don't know. You took a class. I only did 7 minutes of TV.
Well, I did not remember Prosperity Rules, the name, so clearly...
We should get the game out and oh, that'd be so good. I think you can actually
it's
play
it. It's on Switch.
Smart. Not only Monopoly, not the landlord's game, sadly. Yeah.
Sadly, not the landlord's game.
I just love her as this prototypical like indie developer that's like, I want to teach people a polemical point with my game design.
Totally.
Because that was the birth of board games, you know, and so it was remarkable for someone to have. There were other board games were becoming a popular thing, but, you know, it was her insight to be like, I'm going to use this as like an exemplary, you know, learning through game design is like 100 years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
That's totally. So rad.
Shout out.
So Tuesday at 10 on True TV.
Thank you so much, yes. Adam.
Adam, I want to give you the opportunity to plug anything else you want to plug. Plug time.
Okay. Twitch at twitch.tv/AdamConover. If you go to adamconover.net, you can see my upcoming tour dates,
nice.
Which are going to be in cities all across the country. You can follow me on Twitter at AdamConover. And Humans Who Make Games, I'll just be tweeting. I'm going to tweet the link to that very soon, so you can go find that on my Twitter or just Google it. It's also on IGN and Starburns Audio.
What is your Twitter?
My Twitter is AdamConover, at AdamConover.
Yep. Oh, that's very good that you got that one.
Yes.
Smart and good. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
being here and being awesome.
I'm just a fan, and I think it would be fun to do this every day.
Hell yeah. Well, Come on down.
And if that happened, I bet we'd get a podcast studio.
Yeah, right. If you were here.
If you were.
Adam. See, I'm seeing Adam everywhere. I'm seeing your face everywhere, just like Natalie did in LA. Austin, where can we find you online?
At Austin_Walker.
Natalie, where can we find you online?
At Natalie Watson.
You can find me at Danielle R.I. And you can, of course, listen to the beautiful track. You can learn more about the beautiful track you're hearing right now at waypoint.zone/ BOEN. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. Thank you all, everyone, so much. Thank you again to Adam Conover for
being
here
and
not ruining Waypoint Radio. Appreciate that very much.
Wish you would.
Open invitation.
Yeah, anytime.
I'll come up with something scathing for next time.
Thank you.
That's perfect. We appreciate it. Thank you, everyone. And I would always remind you to be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.